At least 58 people now dead, more than 500 people wounded.
17 fires burning right now in the state, 5,700 structures destroyed, at least 35 people dead.
I mean, this was a massive church just outside of San Juan with a congregation of 3,000 people. Maria just shredded this building.
ISIS released a new video today showing the execution of 21 Coptic Christians kidnapped in Libya.
Two suicide bombings killed more than 40 people on one of the holiest days on the Christian calendar.
North Korea fires yet another missile, but Pyongyang claims this one will be able to hit the U.S. mainland, striking cities like Los Angeles, Denver, even New York and Boston.
They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
The world seems so unstable, so insecure. Everything is changing way too fast. But there are some things that are steadfast, things that never change: God and His Word. Randy Reams is pastor of Kindred Bible Church in Nampa, Idaho. Join Pastor Randy now as he shares truths from God's unchanging Word.
First Samuel chapter 7, we'll read verses 1 through 6. We will cover the whole chapter, but for our time of reading, we will do verses 1 through 6. And the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on a hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. Now, you're going to forgive me if my version reads a little different than yours. I'll explain that in a minute. Time went by until 20 years had passed since the ark had been taken to Kiriath-Jearim. Then the whole house of Israel began to seek the Lord. Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, "If you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, remove your foreign gods, that is, or your Baals, your Asheroth, from among you, and direct your hearts to the Lord, and serve Him only, and He will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines." So the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Asheroths, and served the Lord alone. And Samuel said, "Gather all of Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you." And they gathered at Mizpah, and drew water and poured it out before the Lord and fasted on that day and said, "We have sinned against the Lord." And Samuel judged the sons of Israel at Mizpah. You may be seated. So if you recall, to get to the story up to this point, if you remember, the Philistines went to war against Israel. And Israel, that's the red line. That's when they're moving the ark. First one is at Shiloh. They move to Ebenezer. They go to battle against the Philistines and lose about, you know, I forget, it's 30,000. And the Ark of the Covenant is captured. Remember that? Yes. Okay. There you go. All right. And then they take it down to Ashdod. What happens in Ashdod? Yeah, timbers. I get it. So they put him in the temple of Dagon. Remember? Dagon falls down. They stand him back up. Dagon falls down, his heads and hands fall off, and falls on the threshold of the temple. Those guys had enough of that. They take him to Gath. Gath, and all, just like they do at Ashdod, gets this plague of tumors, all right? And so then they go to move it to Ekron, and Ekron says, "You ain't moving that thing here," okay, because that's not happened to us. So if you recall, they put it on a cart with some cows that had never been pulled a cart or been in a yoke before, and also with a chest of I love the golden tumors, you know what I mean? It sounds sort of gross, but, and then they let it, they says, if this was an act of Israel's God, those cows will lead it off to Israel. If it just goes the other way, we know it was just chance. And of course, it heads off, to Beth Shemesh, all right? But the people of Beth Shemesh didn't respect that, and they opened the ark, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, the movie, I guess. All right. They looked in the ark and 50,000 people die. And they said, "Get rid of the ark." Yeah, we hate it when God's presence brings conviction. But anyway, and we go somewhere else. So they take it to Kiriath-Jearim, all right? And that's where they take it. That brings us to the story today. Now, it's been decades and decades and decades, and Israel has been living in this time of idol worship, this time of other gods, not serving gods. And so when it gets there, they just appoint the local guy, one of his sons, to take care of, not a minister like a priest, where they would do sacrifices, okay? They just took it there, and this son, this guy, Eliezer, was appointed to make sure that it's taken care of. Nothing happens to it, more or less. I want you to understand it wasn't a thing of priesthood. And then when I got to verse 2, I sort of read something different from all you, and I read from the Holman Christian Standard Bible. All right, which is a more modern translation in the sense, but it is an original. Whole bunch of 100 scholars got together and tried to put it in a phrase that you can understand, where direct wording can be used. They use direct wording. But because of languages, those of you that speak different languages know this, you can't necessarily go straight across word for word and have it make sense. And so where they needed to get the idea across, they did that. That's the case in this verse. If you read it in your version, the NAS, the King James, whatever you're in, you're going, what they saying? It really doesn't make sense. So I use the Holman Standard Version there to let you know that what it really means, and 100 scholars wiser than I, basically said this. Time goes by. 20 years goes by from the time that, what do I say? Basically, 20 years of Samuel's ministry goes by. Now, it's got to be frustrating for Samuel to be serving, hearing from God, but the people not listening. How many of you have teenagers and know what that's like? Okay. And so, but after 20 years, notice what they do. They begin to seek God. All right. And he says, God, fine. If you really are serious about seek God, you gotta get rid of your Baals and your Asheroths, okay? And we'll talk about those in a minute, all right? And they decide that, yeah, we're into that. So he goes to this rock, by the way, called the Rock of Our Help. But when the Philistines realize the Israelites are sort of coming back around the idea of their God, they say, we can't have this. And so they decide to attack. Israel gets a little bit afraid. Samuel says, that's all right, hang in there, okay? And you just keep seeking God, and he makes a sacrifice of a lamb, of course, all right, and to the Lord. And so the Philistines attack at Mizpah, all right, they lose. That is different than what's been happening, am I correct? So they lose that. And by the way, this is a fulfillment. How one of the ways they lose is the Bible says this way in most versions, and God thundered a great thunder. That seems a bit repetitive, and it really is, because the words thunder really don't mean it like we mean it. There's two words there, thunder to great thunder. One is a confusing noise, and the other is a voice. Those are the two words that make up that word thunder, thunder. Okay, the two thunders there. So God somehow makes a voice that to all of them confuses them and scares the Philistines. So the Israelites rout them and chase them quite a ways. I didn't put it on the map because it's not relevant to today's story. But if you remember when Hannah, who's Hannah? Samuel's mom. Couldn't have any children, remember? And her husband's other wife mocks her, frustrates her. That's also the same word thunder, by the way. That word of confusion and irritation and, okay. But anyway, it confused her. And she goes to the Lord and says, hey, if you give me a kid, I'll give him back to you, right? And then she says a prayer. And in that prayer, one of the things she does in verse chapter 2, verse 10, is she says in her prophetic prayer that God's going to bring a thunder and deliver them from their enemies. So this is a fulfillment of Hannah's prayer. Of course, many, many, many years later. Verse 14, it says this. After the Israelites rout the Philistines, and the cities which the Philistines taken from Israel had been restored to Israel, and it lists the five cities, the cities that was taken from them. Samuel then becomes a circuit preacher. He makes a circuit all the way up to Dan. The text talks about that. In a year, he'd make the circuit through all Israel, and he'd come back to his home in Ramah, and there he would judge Israel. And so he judges a total of about 40 years. What happens at the end of that 40 years? Oh, we'll find that out, okay, if you don't know. So 40 years, 20 of which the people aren't listening, and 20 of which is in this time of revival, renewal, and restoration. And really, that's what this episode begins, a change in Israel. From, remember those judges, Israel would keep falling away, doing the things, and a judge would come in, and God would have mercy on them, not because they did anything right. He'd come mercy and bring these judges, all right? And Samuel comes along at this point, and so at this point, it shifts. It shifts to a time of, can I use religious, churchy American language, revival. Okay, but we have certain mindset thinking of that, so I call this time of restoration, renewal, all right, if I can call it that. So it's a new time in Israel. So what I wanted to talk to you about today, I hope, things that lead to, first of all, things that lead to renewal, restoration, or that old-fashioned word revival. But we'll talk about some of the misconceptions about that. Well, I'll just do it now. We tend to think in the United States of revival as like some kind of a camp tent meeting that Billy Graham did, and a whole lot of non-believers came it to Christ. That's not revival. That's from death to life. Revival is revive the church, bring it back alive, renew it, restore it, re-energize it, whatever word you want to call it, bring it to where it needs to be. And that's Israel's case here. They had served God before. Then they went prodigal. How many of you know the prodigal son story is not about a lost person? It's not the son trying to find the father. It's the son returning to the father. When did he stop being the father's son? Never. I'm just making sure you understand that theologically. Okay? So what leads to a time of revival, restoration, or renewal? First of all, it's desperation. Right? They've got tired of being oppressed, trampled down and conquered by other people. They got tired of sin beating them up. And what did they do with that? Make the screen go black. No, what did they do with that? They begin to seek God. Notice that. They begin to seek God. They don't seek after the ark, that symbol of Jewish religion. They don't seek after Samuel the prophet. They seek God. So in other words, they didn't get some program that says, this is how to grow the church. They didn't run to that. They didn't find a personality to get behind and say, the personality, he can draw a big crowd. They sought God. So they're seeking God. What does Samuel say? You sinners. Isn't that what you're looking for? Uh-uh. Most of us today aren't looking for it. But that's really what happens, okay, is Samuel says to them, if you're returning to the Lord with all your heart, get rid of your sin, your foreign gods that are among you, and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him only. Pick one. Pick a revival, a renewal, a restoration of the church. Take the Reformation. Pick one in church history. It's always been this. Them indulgences, that's sin. I'm using Reformation here, Martin Luther. It's always where the church, some people get desperate enough where they decide to seek God. Usually it begins with Bible study and prayer. Usually. Is how church history tells us that revivals took place. They decided to seek God. They didn't go follow a person. They didn't say, we know we need to do this religious thing over and over again that we've been doing, that they did way back when. That's not necessarily what they're doing. They say, we want more of God. That's the answer. And then typically a preacher comes along of some sort and says, repent. That's the typical pattern of that. Revival always begins in the pew. That's you. Israel sought God, not Samuel. It was the people decided they had enough, and they decided to seek God. All right? So it begins in the pew. What are the results? And that's not the results we want. First result is recognition of sin. Yep, sure enough, I got a Baal in my house. Do you have one? Yeah, I've got an Asherah in my house. Do you have one? We've got to quit making excuses, or let me put it this way, evading responsibility for our own sin. I don't know how many times I've heard, I just can't help it. Boy, do I got scripture for you this morning. Okay? Or it's the situation, or my upbringing, or maybe I want to blame my genes. Not pants. Okay, my DNA. All right? But I want you to think about it. This is what I often, well, it's just a little, okay? Let me put it in the words of Adam and Eve. It was only one apple. I mean, what's the big deal? One apple. You want to tell me you want to curse all of humanity because of one apple? We don't know if it's an apple, but you know what I'm saying. That's all it was, is one apple. And what does Adam do? He shucks the responsibility. Who does he blame? No, try again. The woman you gave me. Who's he blame? God. God, you tripped me up, God. See, you're the one who brought this thing into my life called woman. Yeah, you did. Oh, man, the arrogance. But right away, he wanted to pass blame. Eve blames the serpent. That's right, okay? So it is people and circumstances around them that right from the get-go, they blame. Well, you don't understand, Pastor. You don't understand what my marriage is like. And that's why I had that affair. Well, you don't understand. I never came from a, I just came from a broken home. So I really don't know what love looks like, a marriage looks like. So I decided to shack up with the fellow. We blame all kinds of things. Now I'm going to meddle a bit. How many of you have turned on the idiot box? I mean the TV. And you can flip through the channels, and what do you say? Man, there's nothing on. You still watch it. See, that's saying you're going to watch the sin, and you're going to say, but there's nothing else on. That's blaming your culture. I'm going to be honest. You may not indulge in it, but you approve in the sense of ratings those who do. Read Romans chapter 1 and 2. Okay, so that got a little more personal and a little bit of meddling. I know that, okay, and I understand that, but I do it on purpose because it tends to tick people off. No, but I'll give you another one, and I get this because I have kids. I've grown kids, middle kids, and little kids, all right? Well, they're going to get exposed to it in the world, you know, but that doesn't mean I have to expose them to it in my house, okay? My little grandson, who's we play classical music during school times. We homeschool, so we play classical music. He walks in the house. God is my witness. I have family. Walks in. The first thing he's looking for is that little speaker. Because if it's Vivaldi, he directs the music. If it's Mozart, he bops his head. Okay? Now, is most likely a young person today going to be exposed to classical music? Mostly, and I'm not saying classical music's of God. I don't mean that, okay? But my point is, I'm going to expose him to what the world won't expose him to because the world's going to expose him to the other. I don't say, well, this is our culture. I've known Christian parents who says, well, you know, we let them have the party at our house because it's better they drink at our house than be somewhere else. You what? Because the world does it, you're going to do it in your house? That don't sound too wise to me. Well, they're going to worship Baals over here, so let's put... No, they would never say that. Okay? But I'm going too far to meddling. Here's the point. You can't blame anybody else but yourself. James chapter 1. James chapter 1. But each one is... Are you in each one? I'm in each one. How about you? You're in each one? Okay. Is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his neighbor. Is that what it says? By his culture. No. By his own lust. Yeah, wait a minute. That means, do I get to blame the devil for it? Then, when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. James tells me, I'm the one to blame for my sin. That don't preach today, folks. There's a show that I've watched late. It follows people's genetics. It looks at your family tree, okay? And often of particular groups, and these particular groups, this particular group often feels like a victim. They're a victim of culture and circumstances. And it hasn't failed yet. Maybe there's been one and I haven't seen it. Where this particular group, they start going back in history. Guess what? One of their relatives are one of those people that they say victimize them. And you should see the look on their face. Wait a minute. I can't blame someone else now. I is one. But I want to talk to you then about types of sin, and it may be in a different sense that you... Notice Israel says, we have sinned against the Lord. That's the congregation at large. Okay, not necessarily you in particular. I'm just saying that that would be bringing to us. That's us, the church, today. How in the world is there corporate sin? We have made worship man self-centered. And I work really hard at trying to make sure that our songs aren't about us. There are still a few I'm trying to get rid of. But that I'm trying to. But you maybe you go, well, that's other people, that's not me. Let me this one. There is a love of brevity in the church. Yeah. In by 11, out by noon. God gets an hour. God gets 2 hours, whatever it is. How do I know? Because when I'm preaching, I watch you look at your watch. Or the worship goes one more song than you think it should. What is that? That's self. God doesn't get tired of worship being worshiped. We might get tired of it. That's self. It's a love of brevity. Okay? The other sometimes we love tradition. Okay, now you probably don't think of us as a traditional, you know, church with a bunch of liturgy, okay? But there are our traditions. Let me skip one and see what happens. Let me just skip a Sunday and forget to call the kids forward. First of all, they mug me afterwards and I'm in trouble. Okay? So, but tradition has its values. It brings stability. But sometimes it is tradition. People go to church for tradition. Are you a Christian? Yeah. Why? Because mom and dad was. What church do you go? First, second, third, eighth Baptist, whatever it is. Well, really, you only go Christmas and Easter, but it's tradition, so that's the thing for you. That's God. But I'm going to say corporately, the church as a whole, at least the church in America, they prefer comfort over truth. Because truth hurts. Oh, truth hurts. I stepped on the scales yesterday morning. Truth hurts. All my life, you know, I'm weighing 175 to 180 pounds. Man, I can't get under 190 now for nothing. Okay? And so it's frustrating. Okay? But the truth hurts. The church prefers receiving over giving. They come to be fed instead of to feed others. Here's the problem. If you come empty to church, you can't feed anybody. That means you have to fill yourself throughout the week. See, church is supposed to be the time when we gather together and celebrate our God and speak about His Word. Okay? That means you have to have something in you to give. All right? Sometimes you have to give out of your lack. I don't doubt that. But church today is about, wait a minute, do you have the ministry I want? Do you have the program I want? Do you preach and have your service within the timetable I want? Is it close enough to the house that I want? That's what we made church into, a consumer marketing product, at least here in the States. So I can drag you over with me to Cambodia and the Philippines, and you're going to be sitting on some little hard bamboo bench for 3.5 hours, and you walked 8.5 miles to get there, you know, through a jungle with Muslims and the NPA. So in America, this tends to be the case. Maybe not in other parts of the world. But I think the other way that we have corporate sin is lukewarmness. I'm just taking out a revelation there. We're not really hot and exuberant for God and His things. We sort of fit it into our timetable, our place, you know. And if somebody asks me, I'll tell them about Jesus maybe. But I sure ain't going to seek that. That's a little embarrassing. That's hard. I'll put it another way, maybe lack of devotion or lack of faithfulness or that kind of thing, okay? And back in the day, that would have called piety, by the way. When you're steadfast, faithful, walk it out daily, that's called piety, if anybody cares about that. But there isn't just corporate sin. That corporate sin there is also manifested in the sin in the leadership. And I think you can't blame this side, and you can't blame that side. I think it's sort of mutual agreement, let's sin together, okay, if I'm that way, okay? Because what you get is man-centered preaching. Seven ways to a happier life. Your best life now. Did you know every day can be Friday? I'm quoting books from one of the largest church pastors in our country, in case you didn't know. Seven ways to financial prosperity. How to have marital happiness. I hate to tell you, marriage ain't intended to make you happy. It's to conform you to the image of Christ. How do I know? I read Genesis. And he made man in our image, male and female. The purpose of marriage is image of Christ, not happiness. Now, I suggest to you, if you pursue being an image of God in your marriage, you'll be a whole lot happier. But there's a difference between outcome and purpose. That self-centered preaching lacks doctrine. Did I say the word doctrine? Oh, how awful. But we do, but we don't want to use it today. We'll have Wednesday night Bible teaching. You know what the word teaching is? Doctrine. Okay? But we're afraid the word doctrine will scare people, so we don't use it. Okay? Maybe I could see some of that. But when I don't teach doctrine, I got to skip Genesis. Do you know all major doctrines of Scripture are found in the book of Genesis? Ready? In the beginning, God. What's that tell you? God was before the beginning. He's eternal. In the beginning, God created. God is the creator. Right? That kind of thing. God is sovereign over that creation. Now, wait a minute. If God's sovereign over that creation, how sovereign is he? A little bit sovereign? By the way, you can't have a little bit sovereign by the definition of the term. You can't be a little bit pregnant, and you can't be a little bit sovereign. You either are sovereign or you aren't sovereign. And trust me, the church today, God ain't sovereign.
This is Pastor Randy Reams of Kindred Bible Church in Nampa, Idaho. I want to thank you for joining us today for Truths from God's Unchanging Word. This broadcast is an outreach ministry of Kindred Bible Church. I'd like to invite you also to visit our website, kindredbible.org. There you can listen to today's broadcast as well as previous broadcast. If you're being ministered to by the broadcast, I'd like to encourage you to let us know. You can email us at info@kindredbible.org, or you can write to us at Kindred Bible Church, P.O. Box 32, Nampa, Idaho, 83653. And I'd like you also to check us out on Facebook. Look at us over there and give us a like. So again, I want to thank you for listening to Truths from God's Unchanging Word.